This episode of the Signal 51 Chronicles is brought to you by Oscar's Pub, 6323 Kent Bowie Boulevard.
Roxo Media House.
A Signal 51 is police code for an investigation, a law enforcement proceeding that is a systemic and thorough attempt to learn the facts about a possible crime that is complex and whose facts and circumstances are generally hidden, at least initially, behind obstacles that can be coincidental and or man-made. Investigations methods are formal. I'm John Henry, a journalist. My partner is Jake White, a retired Fort Worth police sergeant. And together, we examine the difficult cases of law enforcement, both in Fort Worth and around the region. This is Signal 51. The show is designed specifically for a more mature audience. Some of the content is graphic and is not intended for younger audiences. This week on the Signal 51 Chronicles, life is not always a bowl of cherries. Sunday morning, May 2nd, 2010, began like any other for Jeanette Barish, who lived in the mostly quiet town of Colleyville, an affluent suburb in Tarrant County between Fort Worth and Dallas. Its population was exploding, so to speak. Once a community of open spaces, Colleyville was a town of 22,906 at the time, and by the 2020 census, more than 26,000. As more and more find the outskirts of Dallas and Fort Worth the preferable locale to raise a family in good school districts. Jeanette lived in the 1,000 block of Dogwood Court. She planned to go to church that morning, return home for lunch, and enjoy a lazy Sunday afternoon. Summer was giving its annual sneak peek of what is typical in the climes of North Texas. The high was expected to be 97 degrees that day. Actually, out of the ordinary for that time of the month. Nothing seemed out of place, not even a package from FedEx that had arrived early enough for her to notice it sitting on the porch at 8 a.m. Packages to the house, though, weren't out of the ordinary, even in those days before Amazon inserted its big foot in the e-commerce marketplace. It's news today, Jake, actually, if a neighborhood doesn't receive a package on a daily basis.
Oh, absolutely. Via drone.
A
robot dog.
Yeah. Uber. It's either food, a book, electronics, clothes, some sort of human growth hormone.
I've not heard.
We have gotten that before.
Oh.
Anyway, Jeanette in those days had routinely entered sweepstakes and thought nothing suspicious about the package. She brought it inside and continued to get ready for church and on to worship on the Christian Sabbath. When she returned from church at about 11, things got weird. And of course, that's why we're here after all, because things get weird. We wouldn't be talking about this if things didn't get weird. And not only weird, and many times very stupid, particularly during divorce proceedings, people tend to lose their minds. After returning from church, Jeanette took to satisfying her curiosity about the package. She went to the brown FedEx box, which was approximately 2 feet by 2 feet by 3 feet, and she began to cut through the adhesive tape that locked down the flaps, those extensions on the sidewall panels that closed the box. Inside, she found the box contained those all well-to-known packing peanuts and two wooden salad bowls closed together with masking tape. Jeanette separated the bowls and found something queer. What is that, she thought. 6-volt lantern battery wired to a large bag of black and gray powder inside the bowls? What in the hell? Concerned and seeking answers, and perhaps also the consolation of a friend nearby, Jeanette carried the package to the neighbor. Jeanette, the neighbor said, that looks like a bomb. Now alarmed and in a panic, Jeanette called 911. She said breathlessly to the call taker, I opened it and there was a battery in it. My neighbor said it looks like a homemade bomb. Officers arrived. Jeanette told those first responders that the night before around 9:45, she had taken her dog on an evening walk. She didn't see anything on the porch. In her recollection, officers, Jeanette noted a folded dollar bill on her porch underneath the package. After having taken a look at the device, responding officers too believed it was suspicious. They notified those personnel assigned to the Northeast Fire Department Association. The Northeast Fire Department Association was developed by a group of cities in Northeast Tarrant County for the purpose of combining manpower ideas and education for specialty operations. Those operational areas included explosive response. These collectives, I guess what they're called, is small towns can't afford their own fire departments, so they collaborate with other small cities, banding together their resources.
A task force.
Task force.
I think that would be appropriate.
And they make this essential first responder entity doable by combining all those.
Pooling resources.
So those guys from the Northeast Fire Department Association, they arrived and used a remote-controlled vehicle and water cannon to, in the words of the professionals, quote, render the device safe.
They blew it up. With water.
Now enter another agency, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, better known as the ATF. The ATF, of course, I was first introduced to it in the Waco siege with David Koresh and all those guys. No one's finest moment that day.
No.
Well, anyway, Colleyville Police asked for the ATF's assistance. Now, the ATF is that federal law enforcement agency under the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice that, among other things, investigates the illegal use and trafficking of firearms, the illegal use and storage of explosives, acts of arson and bombings, acts of terrorism, and the illegal diversion of alcohol and tobacco products. Now, that sounds like something from the days of Prohibition, I guess.
I think that would be the historical context.
I mean, you saw Smokey and the Bandit, of course.
Yes.
They were transporting alcohol across state lines, and that's why they needed the Bandit. To avoid the agents of the ATF, amongst others, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, if this was indeed a homemade bomb sent through the mail, this was a case for the ATF. An explosives officer of the ATF conducted a cursory examination of the evidence. He found that the device consisted of two wooden salad bowls bound together with masking tape. The bowls, taped together, held the main explosives charge. The explosives charge was 3 pounds of a black-gray powder consistent with smokeless powder. Moreover, the bowls also contained an electrical circuit, exposed wires, a lantern battery, and an automobile-type light bulb with an exposed filament. Investigators also found the device to contain fragment believed to be 9mm projectiles, the same projectiles commonly used in 9mm ammunition. The initial assessment revealed that the device was sure as hell consistent with an improvised explosive weapon, a homemade bomb.
Colleyville detectives and ATF agents began their investigation in earnest. One thing to keep in mind about the Northeast Tarrant Bomb Squad, they didn't just detonate the explosive, they also photographed the device. These photographs proved crucial in the investigation. On May 4th, 2 days later, one of the investigators began to closely examine the photographs taken of the explosive device. The detective noticed the markings B. Smith engraved on the bowl. Believing the markings may provide some clues as to where the bowls were bought, the detective turned to an online search. There, the detective found the identical bowl was sold only at the retail store, Bed Bath & Beyond. The wooden salad bowl was a B. Smith acacia wood round salad bowl. The search for this purchase would seem like searching for the proverbial needle in a haystack. Consider that at the time, there were more than 1,000 Bed Bath & Beyond stores in the U.S. We probably all know what Bed Bath & Beyond is, but it's a retail company that trades in bedding, bathroom, kitchen, and home decor. It's not a place consistent with the presence of dudes. They cater mostly to women who preoccupy themselves with the interior design, and all that extra stuff, like 25 extra pillows on the bed in the house.
You have that. Sure, you have the tent.
But in this case, the wooden salad bowl and the engraving were critical pieces of evidence. Investigators reached out to officials with Bed Bath & Beyond. At the time, the retail chain's company policy required retaining sales records for 90 days. Investigators were hopeful they would uncover some evidence within this retention period. Incredibly, they found only a few weeks prior, there was one transaction, and only one transaction, in the entire U.S. where two of the B. Smith Acacia Wood Round Salad Bowls had been sold. The location was the Bed Bath & Beyond store near the Northeast Mall in Hearst, Colleyville's neighbor, mere miles in between them. 7 miles, in fact, from the home on Dogwood Court. Company officials were readily agreeable in providing investigators security footage of the transaction. The person buying the salad bowls was very familiar to them. They had, in fact, spoken to him the day the bomb was discovered. The estranged husband.
Surprise, surprise. On April 14th, 5 weeks before, 51-year-old David Barish was captured on time-stamped surveillance video buying two wooden salad bowls and another item from Bed Bath & Beyond. Time was 12:18 p.m. The day was Wednesday. David, a local real estate broker, had gone through a difficult divorce proceeding with his wife, now his ex-wife. Jeanette told investigators that David was an expert marksman, and during their marriage, he would reload his own ammunition. On the evening of May 2nd, hours after the bomb was discovered, investigators were surveilling David and noticed that he and his teenage son arrived at David's house at Sulago Drive in North Fort Worth. Investigators spoke with David and his son separately. The son told him that he remembered hearing his father leave the house at about 12:30 a.m. on May 2nd. By the time the son finally fell asleep at 1 a.m., David had not returned home. David, on the other hand, with investigators, was more reticent, more reluctant, far more reluctant to provide information. Actually, he was even more than that. He was described as being confrontational, nervous, and anxious, the latter appearing to manifest in profuse sweating. David said he did not want to talk to investigators, who told him that a bomb had been discovered at his ex-wife's house. David acted surprised, but never asked about the well-being of Jeanette. Eventually, David allowed investigators inside his home, but he denied any involvement. At one point during the interview, detectives used a ruse, telling David that his DNA and fingerprints had been found on the device. David replied something to the effect of, quote, "Oh, great," and then added that he had nothing more to say. Red flags were shooting into the sky like fireworks on July 4th, or perhaps a hungry Jake White at Poncho's. Maybe donuts, I don't know. There was still not enough to arrest David, whose DNA and fingerprints were not actually on the device. So why exactly would David have this response? Yes, it's his ex-wife who caused grief. Everybody thinks the other causes grief in divorces. But it's still hard to imagine he would want to see the mother of his children dead.
David's responses, his actions, were certainly suspicious, and we'll examine that later. Jeanette and David's divorce decree was finalized in June of 2008. Like with so many divorces, property and how to allocate the property seemingly became a source of contention. In some of the news reports, one of the quotes was, Barish's former wife got custody of their two teenage sons and the Colleyville home. Barish's divorce attorney, Lawrence DePlaza, said he could not assign a dollar figure to what the ex-wife was asking for. He said, quote, "It's not that simple. Both sides are claiming that funds and property are owed. A trial date on the matter was set for July."
But ultimately, it was David Barish seen on security cameras buying two wooden bowls. That led to a search warrant signed by a judge and executed on May 5th. An ATF tactical team arrived at David's North Fourth home and conducted the search warrant, something called a dynamic entry warrant. Now, you need to explain that, Jake, before we go on. What is a dynamic entry warrant?
That's that Hollywood type of execution where they're
breaking down the door.
Breaking down the door. And
get your hands up.
Throwing flashbangs in the window and things of the sort. The controversial. Now, yeah. This one was probably not a no-knock warrant. Could have been. I don't know. I didn't. We weren't there for how it was executed, but they're the type of warrants that have fallen under scrutiny.
Well, it's important, as you mentioned in our pre-gaming, it's important to keep in mind that they suspected this man was responsible for constructing a bomb, after all, sending it to his ex-wife, the mother of his children. He was also believed to be an expert marksman. So knocking on the door was not on the table as if a kid looking for a Halloween treat. When investigators entered, they found a treasure trove of evidence.
According to news reports, in quote, during the search of Barish's house in the 5200 block of Sulago Drive, authorities found a Bed Bath & Beyond shopping bag, packing tape consistent with the tape used in sealing the FedEx box, 9mm projectiles, handwritten documents with references to the manufacturing and utilization of improvised explosive devices, solder and soldering irons, and automobile turn signal bulbs. Investigators also found a handwritten note in a suitcase packed with men's clothing that said, quote, "Detectives, I was not planning on leaving. This is from a cruise I just took." A few other noteworthy discoveries. Barish, 1 year prior, had bought a few books from Delta Press. Yes, the same place where you could order books such as the Anarchist Cookbook or books on how to make a homemade suppressor. These, though, were not the books Barish bought. Barish bought books on how to make bombs. Pursuant to the evidence discovered in Barish's home, he was taken into federal custody and charged with possession of an unregistered destructive device.
After being taken into custody, a detention hearing was held the next day. It was the first, or one of the first, in Federal Magistrate Jeffrey Curitin's courtroom. Matthew K. Belcher, Barish's court-appointed defense attorney, said he would attempt to get his client out of jail at the hearing Tuesday. There is good evidence, Belcher said, that David should be released before his trial. Assistant U.S. Attorney Brett Helmer disagreed. Quote, "He's a danger to his wife and a danger to the community," the prosecutor said. Instead of moving on after the divorce, he thought it would be better to put a bomb on her porch. He tried to kill her. It wasn't an impulsive act, Helmer argued. He ordered bookmaking bombs a year ago. It was determined that David would remain in jail until his trial.
You know, John, my favorite bar in West Fort Worth, little place called Oscar's Pub.
Never heard of it. Where is it?
6323 Camp Bowie.
Oh, I do know this place.
Yes. I have been told and have experienced they serve the best cocktails in West Fort Worth.
Pretty tasty.
And at a price that can't be beat.
Cannot.
And a staff that could not be more friendly.
Ugh. I'm telling you.
And when you walk in there, they made a show. They made a TV show in the early 80s, mid 80s. Very much a resemblance.
Heard about it. You're talking Cheers.
It's the exact same thing. You walk in.
Where everybody knows your name.
Everybody knows your name.
Telling you what. Also, it is a very friendly place. In fact, there's an order there that says, or a directive there that says, be nice or leave. That's how friendly this place is.
And they mean it, too.
Oh, yeah, they mean it, too. And I'm telling you what else. Do not sleep on those tacos in that taco truck. It sits right outside. Oh,
no, sir.
I've had tacos and burritos there. I think it's Gordo's taco truck out there. And it is...
they're good.
It is good. They're really good. I mean, even if you don't want to go, even if you don't want to, like tonight, I'm got to go back to the office. And I'm going to swing by there and not drink 1 ounce of liquor. I'm just going to get a burrito.
Get a burrito.
Get a burrito and say hello to some people.
Get back in front of the keyboard.
Exactly so. So, Oscar's Pub, 6323 Camp Bowie Boulevard. Be there or be square. Now, Jake, we did some research. Actually, you did the bulk of this research. Why did this bomb not go off when it was opened? What's up with that?
One little detail.
Did he blow this, so to speak?
Either on accident or on purpose.
All right.
We're going to get to that. But investigators discovered the filament of the auto tail light was broken when he inserted it into the gunpowder. The broken filament was the reason why the bomb did not explode when Jeanette opened it. That filament from the automobile light was the piece that would have completed the circuit.
In October 2010, David pleaded guilty to the charge of possessing an unregistered destructive device. He was sentenced by the late Judge John McBride in a federal courtroom in Fort Worth. Jeanette addressed the court, asking the judge to throw the book at her husband, giving him the maximum sentence of 10 years for possession of an unregistered explosive device. Said Jeanette, quote, "I'm a little disappointed that they're not going after attempted murder in this case." The judge said he would have liked to give him 25 years, but according to the law, he could not. The judge, however, did oblige Jeanette and gave him 10 years.
An upward departure.
Yeah, he said he couldn't give him the 25 years, but he did give him an upward departure. What is that terminology?
So an upward departure, it means a departure that affects a sentence greater than a sentence that could be imposed under the applicable guideline range, or a sentence that is otherwise greater than the guideline sentence. So a little bit more stiff, severe, if you will, more than what was recommended.
So he could give him 10 years, or yeah, he could give him an upward. So in this case, I think it was 3 or 4 years was recommended. Yeah,
the recommendation, the guidelines, was 3 or 4. And he threw the book at him and maxed him out at 10 years.
So the max was 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
But like with everything in this case, there's a lot to unpack. So first, we touch on the familiar topic of intimate partner violence, domestic violence, whatever you want to call it. Aside from the murder we covered in the Nikki Blahitka story, I would think this is probably the most extreme one we've seen.
Not just everybody mails bombs, homemade bombs to their ex-wives.
Yeah, no. Thank God that doesn't happen often.
There'd be a lot of them sent.
Sadly, you're correct there. There was one thing that stood out. The neighbors, they didn't have the best things to say about old David either. One said, quote, "He was not friendly at all. To be honest, what he's charged with, that does surprise me. That's premeditated. That's severe. I didn't think he was that angry."
Angry dude, huh?
Apparently so.
I think we know those guys.
Yeah.
So, one element that stood out was David ultimately pleaded guilty in federal court, but the crime ultimately would seem to be an attempted murder of his ex-wife. That seems like something that the Tarrant County District Attorney could take up.
Yeah. This one, it on the surface, has that Hollywood portrayal of the feds coming in and taking over the case from the locals, if you will.
Yeah.
But honestly, what it comes down to is what set of laws are most applicable. In this case, I think it was federal law. I mean, at the end of the day, there's a lot to prove when you're looking at something like a murder, a criminal attempt murder, a criminal attempt capital murder, whatever the case may be. There's a whole lot to prove on that. Well, with this unregistered device, there's one thing to prove: possession. That's all.
And that's what they could.
And that's what they could. So, I mean, remember what they found in the house. So they find the bomb. They detonate it. They piece it back together. They have photographs of it. They have surveillance tapes of him buying the exact two bowls. They find items that were or similar to what was contained inside the device that was sent to Jeanette. So proving it, I think it did prove to be a little bit easier in the federal system.
Yeah.
And I think also, albeit 10 years does not seem like a long time for somebody who makes a bomb, mails it to his wife's house. 10 years to me doesn't seem that long. But he had or could have had the ultimate defense, because we don't know if that filament,
you know, right,
somewhere along the way, the defense came up with the idea that, no, he's just trying to scare her. He didn't intend to kill her. He's just trying to scare her. So that filament was broken intentionally.
Right.
However, some of the other sources mentioned the fact that even if it didn't explode, I mean, you still had 3 pounds of smokeless powder. I mean, what if it went off in the FedEx truck? Or not, well, I guess it wouldn't have gone off in the FedEx truck, but what if it would have caught on fire in the house? I mean, a number of things. I mean, it still would have done significant harm.
FedEx driver gets in an accident.
Well, here's the deal. FedEx driver didn't deliver it. It was Sunday.
Well, that's right.
we get hung up on the FedEx box, but where was he at 12:30 in the morning on May 2nd?
Right.
Right. The box, because the box wasn't there the night before. She walked, she took her dogs on a walk.
9:45.
The box wasn't there. Son hears them leave at 12:30. She sees the box there at 8 a.m. She just didn't take, or she took it inside. She just didn't open it right away because she's getting ready for church or whatever. But again, I like I said, I think the Fed charges were easier to prove. I think they likely carried a more severe sentence. Albeit 10 years does not seem long. I think that's still more than he would have received in state court. But there is one other thing. That folded up dollar bill.
Oh, yeah.
And that dollar bill was symbolic. Mm-hmm. That dollar bill was meant to be the last dollar he would pay his ex-wife. So, I don't know. You know, this case, like so many, they make, from a logical perspective, they make zero sense.
Oh, yeah. Stupid.
Yes. Horrible, horrible idea.
Now, he obviously was stuck on some sort of, I don't know, palimony, child, you know, spousal support or something, whatever it's called in Texas.
Something. Well, I mean.
Because he claimed that was the last dollar he was gonna pay her.
Yeah, I guess he probably was child support.
He at least had child support.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I think you've told me once before that you have experience with Judge McBride, or you know of people who've had experience. He has a reputation.
Oh yeah,
the judge who sentenced him in this.
It was intimidating going in there.
Yeah,
I mean, I was just a cop, right? I mean, I'm testifying on the witness stand
on drug cases, right?
On drug cases, but it was Hollywood in there, dude. Like, they had the gigantic oil painting picture of him in his robe.
Yeah.
The bailiff would walk
in. Was it behind him or?
No, it was off to the side. Some Latin inscription in the stone.
Uh-huh.
Like I said, the bailiff would walk in, do the all rise.
It was like his domain.
Oh, it was 100% his domain. And it was old school. I mean, there always seemed to be in modern day, there seemed to be obstacles in terms of how things could be presented, and the list went on. I think there were a lot of attorneys that were
hated him.
Oh,
I read his obit. He died just like late last year. I think he was in his 90s or something when he,
yeah.
He was appointed by George Herbert Walker Bush in 1989.
Yeah. Close to that.
Yeah, 1989. And then he became, it's semi-retired, but they call it senior status.
Senior status,
exactly.
Yeah. I don't know exactly. I mean, I know that from what I understand, they still, I don't know that they're necessarily in the courtroom taking cases. Maybe they are.
They take the cases that they want to take.
Okay.
That's the way I read it.
Okay, yeah.
And he did that for, I don't know, last, and then, well, Donald Trump appointed his successor.
Yep.
So it must have been between 2017 and 2021.
Yeah.
He became senior status, and he was active in that role up until he died, which was late last year.
It was in that role. I think it was somewhere around there. I had a buddy that went in there and tried to get a warrant signed.
Uh-huh.
And his pen ran out of ink.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to say literally threw the pen, but became very upset that the pen ran out of ink and told my buddy to come back when he has a pen that works. So he did. He came back with a whole bag of them just in case. But well, he was intimidating.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And at one time, I mean, he was investigated at one time for, I forget the terminology they used, but, you know, defense attorneys said he was belligerent to them, and he compromised justice because of his temperament on the bench. And he was, in fact, I guess, suspended for a period of time. He couldn't take on any new cases. He could only deal with the cases that he had active. That went on for about a year. He couldn't take on any new cases.
Wow. I mean, yeah, he was controversial. I mean,
extremely controversial. So the last thing that David, I'm sure, wanted was to see Judge McBride on this case.
Perhaps one of the one and only courtroom in the entire United States of America that he did not want to go into. That's where he ended up. And again, I mean, look on this one, the upward departure, 10 years, the judge saying, I would have given him 25.
I would have if I could have.
And he would have.
That's what he said. I would have given him 25 if I could have.
I don't know.
Well, he got what he deserved.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're wrapping this one up. We're Cowboys fans across the DFW Metroplex are sulking, sad.
Oh, yeah. Another
year of disappointment and
more Dak Prescott coming.
I laughed. I heard a guy quoted, I don't know if you know who Eddie Sutton is.
I do know who Eddie Sutton is.
Eddie Sutton, the old basketball coach, Oklahoma State.
Great basketball coach, Eddie Sutton.
Yeah, he said, always have faith in God, yourself, and the Cowboys. Now, Eddie Sutton was referring to the Oklahoma State Cowboys, yeah. But
I've heard of another Eddie Sutton out there somewhere, but I can't place
Yeah, I don't remember where that is. I don't know that, you know, that quote provides much solace or peace for those Cowboys fans, but I guess they should always have faith in them.
Sun came up on Monday.
It did. Or did was it? I think it was cloudy. I don't know.
It could have been.
Well, ultimately, I guess justice prevailed. David pleaded guilty. Tragedy was
averted.
Could have been intentionally. It could have been accidentally. We don't know, but you know, again, we go back to the idea of the domestic violence, whether they're married, not married, divorced, in the process of getting the divorce. I think conflict resolution is a skill that perhaps should be taught a little bit more in society.
Sure should.
Then we wouldn't have any stories to tell, though.
Yeah, then we'll, what would we be doing at 9:30 on a Wednesday night?
No, that's true. Well, we can't forget our listeners to stop by Oscar's Pub, 6323 Camp Bowie.
Yeah.
I think that's going to do it.
That's all we got.
Until next time.
See ya.
Roxo Media House.